Welcome to Oncology Nursing Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. Today we bring you the first in a series of 11 CNE programs from the 2025 Oncology Nursing Society Annual Congress in Denver. Our group has been participating in the ONS Congress for 17 years, and this program focuses on the management of patients with ovarian cancer. Our nursing faculty includes Ms. Courtney Arn from the James Cancer Center in Columbus, Ohio, Ms. Jennifer Phillippe from the Massachusetts General Hospital Cancer Center in Boston, and our gynecologic oncologist faculty were Dr. David O'Malley, also from the James Cancer Center in Columbus, Ohio, and Dr. Shannon Weston from the MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston. Conflict of interest statements for the faculty can be found in the program notes. Note that in these meetings, we may discuss the use of agents and treatments that are not approved, so check out the package inserts for more information. Our meeting started with a discussion of the recent history of progress in the treatment of patients with ovarian cancer. So just a couple of words to kind of get started here in terms of an overview. And Shannon, you know, when I think about ovarian cancer, at least from our perspective in education, things really started to ramp up just around 2018, I would say. Yeah. You know, before that, it seems like we're just talking about chemotherapy, bevacizumab, surgery. And of course, in 2018, we learned, and then we saw the data presented by Dr. Katie Moore of the first phase three of many phase three trials, or a number of phase three trials, looking at PARP inhibitors. This was a solo one trial looking at olaparib. And just to get started, I just asked Shannon maybe to comment a little bit on kind of an overview of how, you know, we just came back from the, our group went to the Society of Gynecologic Oncology meetings recently in Seattle. And it's to me really amazing how gynecologic oncology's changed really since that time. Yeah. Can you kind of provide a little bit of an overview, Shannon, of before and after 2018?
Yeah, I mean, I think you nailed it already, right? Before 2018, everybody was getting the same treatment, paclitaxel and carboplatin, regardless of histologic abnormalities, genetic and genomic abnormalities. And I think the SOLO-1 study and then the subsequent PRIMA studies and PAOLA-1 studies that Dr. O'Malley is going to discuss really exploded and gave us such an opportunity to be more thoughtful around what targeted therapies we might use, how we can improve patients' lives with maintenance strategies. So not just stopping after six cycles of therapy and saying, okay, good luck, and we'll hope your cancer doesn't come back, even though we know 80% of the time it will. We now have a little bit more directed options. But as we'll talk about in the genetic portion, not everybody has the predictive biomarkers that would indicate PARP is going to be helpful. And so we were struggling a little bit with the other abnormalities and what to do with the patients that don't have those. And I think what's really blown up, and we'll talk about this in Module 4, is this idea around antibody-drug conjugates where we can use protein expression, which is much more common in patients with ovarian cancer, to direct a more targeted therapy. So it's been very exciting.
So, Dave, you know, another thing that's kind of interesting about ovarian cancer, in a way, kind of reminds me of yesterday we did a program on prostate cancer where you have both medical oncologists and urologists involved. And here we have gynecologic oncologists and medical oncologists. You know, it was interesting. We did an entire program, and Dave ran it at the SGO meeting on HER2-positive gynecologic cancers, the antibody-drug conjugate, TDXD. And, you know, this had already come into medical oncology practice in breast cancer. They were already used to using it. Now all of a sudden the gynecologic oncologists were using it. And you know, we went out and did videos with a bunch of community-based oncologists. I was amazed. They had come up to speed. They were using TDXD. Mm-hmm. Again, I'm just kind of curious about this sort of interface between medical oncology, gynecologic oncology, Dave, how you see that playing out both in an academic center like yours, but also in the community. Like, how does it determine, you know, it seems like more and more sophisticated drugs are being used. Where do you see that playing out?
Well, I think it's quite different regionally. Like in Boston, the medical oncologist, almost all the institutions deliver the chemotherapy, the GY oncologists do the surgery, and they collaborate. Many of our institutions, like my own and Shannon's, we do it both. And I love that because, for one, I'm ADD. So, you know, if I get bored with the medical, I go to the surgical. But, you know, when we really, we appreciate the limits to both of them. But it is a lot when you're also having a surgical expertise. And some people have decided it's too much for me. I'm going to partner with a medical oncologist to deliver the care in the community where many of you work is, you know, whatever comes to the door, you're going to see. So keeping this all straight across all of that, I am not smart enough. I have a trouble with my three cancers. I couldn't imagine doing what many of our community oncology does to try to keep up on this. So it is an education when you have new agents, and thank goodness for programs like this.
And Jennifrine also brings up another theme in oncology. Again, we talk about themes, which is interdisciplinary collaboration. You know, we've talked about gynecologic oncology and medical oncology, but so many other disciplines that can be involved in terms of imaging, you know, ophthalmology, we're going to talk about ophthalmic issues. Any thoughts about how that plays out in the community, again, versus an academic center like yours?
Yeah, I think in ways it's the same. You can find the people that you want to collaborate with, whether you're at an academic center or in the community. For example, and we'll talk about this a little later, but with mirvetuximab, we partnered with ophthalmologists, and I literally just cold emailed people and got some yeses, and thank goodness we did, because there are a lot of side effects that we'll talk about. But you can do that in the community too, and even sometimes the pharmaceutical reps will go out to the eye care centers and be able to give a little overview of that.
Yeah, yesterday we were talking about some of the newer agents in breast cancer cause glucose intolerance. You know, it's been a while since oncologists dealt with diabetes and in that level of detail. Last night we were talking about the Bruton tyrosine kinase inhibitors and all the cardiologic effects. So it's more and more an interdisciplinary endeavor. Well, I just want to kind of bring up a patient. This is actually a patient of Courtney and Dave's, of a patient in her 50s who had ovarian cancer. And maybe you can talk a little bit, Courtney, about how she presented and how that compares. And maybe we can just chat a little bit about how these people present and the initial experience they have with this disease.
Yeah. Speaking of the community, she presented to her local emergency room with abdominal pain. They did a CT scan that showed bilateral pelvic masses. They drew tumor markers and showed that she had elevated CA125, and then she was referred to our office, and Dr. O'Malley did her surgery, was found to have advanced ovarian cancer, and received adjuvant chemotherapy.
How was her surgery, Dave?
Well, you know, we were able to get most of the disease out, all what we could see or feel. So she had a complete cytoreductive surgery. You know, we spent a lot of time making that decision. Should we do neoadjuvant versus primary? Her CAT scan appeared that we would be able to get all of the disease in R0 resection out. And so we did proceed with primary debulking surgery in this scenario.
How do you make that decision, Shannon, you know, between, it seems like there are more and more ideas of using neoadjuvant chemo, sometimes with bevacizumab, particularly in patients with ascites or effusions. How do you decide whether to go right to surgery or give pre-op systemic therapy?
Yeah, I mean, I think David kind of got at the idea of where is the disease, right? Because the goal of cytoreductive surgery in this setting is to remove all evidence of disease. We have very clear data around that. And in the past, we didn't know if neoadjuvant was as good as cytoreductive surgery. But now we have data to say, randomized controlled trials that say it is. And so we can be a little bit more selective. So outside of things like disease that I know I can't remove, we also look at patient factors, right? What's her performance status? You know, is she going to be able to tolerate surgery? Is there any reason that we think it would be ideal to give that chemotherapy first? And I think we're seeing more and more that that's happening.
So, Courtney, it looks like she got a strategy that's often used, and it looks like very successful. You know, we'll see the curves from the data from the trial and what a difference it is in a patient like this to get a PARP inhibitor or not. That was what was so revolutionary, what happened in 2018 when we saw when Katie said when she saw those curves, she could barely believe it. And it was really amazing to look at. So she got chemotherapy with typically used carboplatin paclitaxel. She did not get bevacizumab. She went on 2 years of olaparib, and I'm curious, Courtney, how she tolerated the chemo, how she tolerated the olaparib, and also maybe a little bit about her. You know, one of the themes we have here is why was it different to take care of this patient than another patient in the same oncology situation, but a different person, different attitude, social situation, et cetera. Can you talk a little bit about this woman and why, what made her different and how she tolerated treatment?
Yeah. While receiving chemotherapy, we referred her to our genetic counselor, and we found out that she had a BRCA2 germline mutation. So immediately we started talking to her about our plan for maintenance therapy. And you want to start this conversation early. You don't want to wait till they finish their 6 cycles of chemotherapy to start the conversation of what their maintenance therapy will be. So we started talking to her about it early on. As soon as she finished her chemotherapy, we started the maintenance olaparib. She completed 2 years. She tolerated it really well with minimal side effects. She did not require any dose modification. She completed her 2 years. She's currently no evidence of disease for 3 years now since completing maintenance therapy. Something interesting about her is she was adopted, so that, you know, made her genetic testing a little bit more interesting than some of our patients. She had really good family support, which I think helped get her to her appointments, helped with her tolerance of treatment. She also had a stroke at a young age. She had some residual left-sided weakness, but otherwise she was doing okay, but that impacted her care a little bit as well.
Interesting. Interesting that she was adopted. And Jennifer, of course, you know, typically in patients with germline mutations, you start thinking about the family. We've had plenty of cases of patients. I remember a patient with pancreatic cancer, which we're going to talk about tonight, who unfortunately passed away but was found to have a BRCA germline mutation. I think the daughter was also found out BRCA positive, was able to undergo preventive surgery and avoid, you know, having breast cancer. Also, the same thing with prophylactic oophorectomy. Any thoughts, any comments, Jennifer, about how you see the issue with the family playing out? Do you see some patients who don't want to be tested? They don't want to have to, you know, kind of tell their family that that this has happened.
I do see that. I think that's more rare, thankfully, and oftentimes we're able to kind of not persuade, but let people know the importance of it. I have one patient that's coming to mind. She has a BRCA1 germline mutation and has twin girls. She's doing fabulously. She had actually recurrent disease, and she's on a PARP inhibitor currently. At the time of presentation, PARP inhibitors didn't exist. So now she's, 5 years on a PARP inhibitor. And we've kind of like watched the twin girls grow up, and they're in their 20s now, and we'll get tested, I think, probably closer to 30.
That's interesting. So they held off on the testing because they wouldn't change anything.
Yeah, and you can kind of understand that. You know, they see their mom go through this awful thing. I could see it go either way, you know. But they will get tested.
Another theme is patient involvement in decisions. You know, when it's not clear exactly what the best course is, it's always good to ask the patient if they want to be involved in the decision. So we're going to start out now and talk about genetic testing and just testing in general in ovarian cancer. Again, another major theme in oncology, biomarker-guided therapy. You see this in almost every cancer and hematologic cancer, looking in the tumor for clues as to what kind of therapy, particularly some type of more targeted treatment. So, Chana, let's talk about ovarian cancer in terms of testing.
Absolutely. So, yes, I'll be discussing the genetic testing component in newly advanced diagnosed ovarian cancer. And this is the course. I'm not going to go through this slide in detail. It's a bit of level setting. And you just heard this case from Courtney where, you know, that this person kind of followed the playbook of what we typically see at diagnosis. And of course, you know, as we're making decisions around what to treat the patient, when to do surgery, the big thing the big opportunity to intervene really is with that genetic testing. Now, I want to make sure just we're all on the same page about what mutations we can see. So germline mutations are going to be things that are passed through the family, and the entire organism is going to carry that mutation, versus somatic mutations, which can be very important clinically in how we treat the patient, are really only affected in one area. So in this case, our ovarian cancer. So I think that's really an important way to distinguish when we're talking about the different tests. Now, when we talk about the potential for genetic mutations in ovarian cancer and those that really portend the most risk of ovarian cancer, BRCA1 and 2 are obviously the highest risk. Those are the most common, occurring at about 15 to 20% of all patients. But there's other factors in the DNA damage repair pathways, what's called homologous recombination repair pathways, that can be really important in both patients having ovarian cancer and also in the way that we might treat their ovarian cancer. And those include more rare mutations, but important, like RAD51D, RAD51C, PALB2, BRIP1. These are all really relevant. And then, of course, Lynch syndrome is also incredibly important. Now, that's where we see more commonly colorectal cancers and uterine cancers, but ovarian cancer can be seen in about 15% of those. And those are mutations that are in the mismatch repair pathway, such as MLH1, MSH2, MSH6, PMS2, and EpCAM. And the bottom line is all the oncology groups agree everyone with ovarian cancer, epithelial ovarian cancer, should undergo genetic testing. Now, I'm not going to go through this in as much detail, but it's just to kind of let you know that there are other potential aberrations in the patient's tumor that may impact not only cancer risk, but also treatments that they can receive, the PARP inhibitors that we've discussed, and really up to 50% of patients with ovarian cancer may have some abnormality either in their germline or in their somatic tumor that could predict benefit from those very important drugs. But first, if we identify a germline mutation, not only is it important for the way we're treating our patient, but it's also important for their family. We know that when there's a germline inherited mutation, it's a 50-50 chance for first-degree relatives to also have that mutation. So we have the opportunity for cancer prevention, like we talked about in those 20-year-old twins, and screening for early detection, both in family members as well as in the patient themselves. And unfortunately, even though we've known this for a long time, even though we have these great treatments with PARP inhibitors, we're still not doing our best. This was a meta-analysis from 2021, and unfortunately, I suspect the numbers aren't very different, where only 40% of patients were being referred, and of those, only 30% were actually completing genetic testing. So there's a huge opportunity here to intervene and make an impact on the patient and her family. And unfortunately, what we did see, in addition to just boldly across the board not having high numbers, that it was worse in underrepresented minority population in those patients that don't have prior insurance. So there's a huge opportunity to make an impact here. And so we can do a couple of different testing paradigms for ovarian cancer, whether we get the germline first, whether we get somatic tumor testing first, and then prompt a germline test if that's positive. Regardless, we need to get these tests. And really, we're also looking for other ways to identify homologous recombination deficiency. Now, that's not going to be as important for family, but that's going to be very relevant for patient and for what treatments that she might receive. And so I don't have the time to go through every different test, but this is just meant as a reference for you. There are tests that offer that HRD testing irrespective of mutations that looks at things like loss of heterozygosity, telomeric allelic imbalance, large-scale state transitions. The bottom line is this makes the tumor potentially responsive and sensitive to PARP inhibition. And you can get this through tests that only offer that, or what we like to favor is getting it where we can also get next-generation sequencing, where we can do a really deep dive on that patient's tumor and look at the genetic abnormalities there. And then I'll just mention just briefly, moving on to the next, you know, Dr. O'Malley is going to talk a lot about the use of PARP inhibitors. We also have to decide early on about the use of bevacizumab. And in our institution, we've really been favoring that for patients that test negative for everything else. Because I have a hard time not giving a maintenance to somebody with ovarian cancer. And if I don't feel as good about giving, say, PARP inhibitors in a patient population that tests negative, I like to use Bev there. And so I think I'll stop there and thank you all for your attention.
So just a couple of follow-up points. You were talking about Lynch syndrome, and you can also see the same abnormality without it being genetic, MSI high disease. And the important thing from the point of view of the patient, these patients are tumors are extremely sensitive to immunotherapy, and you know excellent responses that you see throughout oncology. Another, I was flashing back to last night when we were talking about prostate cancer, because PARP inhibitors are very prominent, and they were saying that the men are trying to figure out why they're positive for a BRCA and a breast cancer mutation, but you see it not just in women or in breast cancer, but also prostate. Jennifer, another thing about the comments about genetic counseling, you know, the pandemic really revolutionized what we do because of the acceptance of Zoom, mm-hmm. and now it's like amazing what we're able to do in education. I've been kind of disappointed. I was expecting it to be infiltrated more into clinical practice. There've been a lot of obstacles to that, particularly in terms of genetic counseling. Are there services of online where you can, without having to go in to see a patient?
There are, and it probably varies institution to institution. We do something really cool at Mass General. Our genetics team is doing a study where patients are given iPads, and they're taken through different levels of genetic testing, with just the BRCA genes being one panel, a moderate panel, and then test everything you can panel. And it takes them through this, and then at the end, we as the team do all the work of sending off the blood and getting the results back. And then if there's a positive result, or if the patient does want to see the genetic counselor, at that time we can refer. And that just saves the genetics team time, because they are such a coveted resource right now.
Yeah, and that's a great concept there, because to focus on the people who are positive, let the primary providers sort of provide an intro, and then try to get these patients, or at least certainly offer them genetic counseling. All right, well, let's move to we've talked about the testing, and interesting that, it's not just an issue for the patient, which we're talking about today, but also for the family. Dave, let's talk about a situation like your case that we just presented, a patient who's found to have a BRCA mutation. We're saying germline, but really, whether it's germline or somatic, it seems, at least in terms of response, be very similar. The patient gets 6 cycles of chemo, just like your patient did, and is about to start PARP maintenance. So we asked you to talk about some of the clinical research studies that led to this strategy, what the impact is. This patient you have now, who's been free of disease for several years now, what would the likelihood overall have been without PARP inhibitors that she'd be free of disease at this point?
The 15% plus or minus 5%. Cross time, 15% plus or minus 5%. Unbelievably consistent. And so, meaning, and if you're disease recurs, you died of ovarian cancer. And as we look here in the results from a PARP inhibitor in the first line setting, and we'll talk about this, and Shannon and I have talked a lot about this over the years, is you need to use your best therapies early on. So this is a little bit different than what Shannon presented for the NCCN guidelines. This is adopted of the big decisions we have made. We talked about them, all right, neoadjuvant, okay, first versus primary debulking, Bev, no Bev. And then maintenance, And I agree with you, Shannon. In my world, when I talk to these patients, it's no longer are we going to do maintenance, but which maintenance should we do? So put that into context. And this is some of the references that we would go through in talking about this. And how do PARP inhibitors work? Well, it's the DNA repair mechanism within the cells. And it disrupts that. In cancer cells, they don't want to die. And so if we can get them to have abnormalities, and then that abnormalities become a second abnormality, then the cell dies, synthetic lethality. So we're messing around the DNA repair of the cells. Cancer cells don't die. Their DNA, those cells, and so when we introduce these changes, then the cell dies. And that's what we think PARP works. And we heard a lot from Shannon, but it probably has multiple different ways that it does work. We've already referred to SOLO-1. This was the drop the mic. This was of the trial that looked at BRCA mutations. It was somatic or germline, but almost all the patients, except like 6, had germline because we weren't doing somatic testing at that time. 2 years of PARP inhibitor, in this case, a olaparib versus placebo, a 2-to-1 randomization. But I've included here the most updated survival. In this case, it was time to subsequent therapies, first subsequent therapy. This is a surrogate that you never recurred. And now look at those numbers. 7 years, 84 months, 45% have not started a subsequent therapy or have not died. We went from, remember I said 15% plus or minus 5%? I didn't lie to you. It's still 20%. Versus 45%. And at the same time, subsequently then, we said, well, if it works in BRCA, it should work in other patients. And so we tested, we then did a trial with all comers and have a little higher risk population instead of 2 years, now 3 years. Once again, 2-to-1 randomization, but now this is with niraparib rather than olaparib. Once a day, a little bit different, and Courtney's going to talk more about the dosing. This was the primary analysis in the tumor marker positive test that Shannon referred to, HRD positive. And you see the differences between those curves. You don't have to be a statistician to say those are clearly different. But what we wanted to see is we want to say, okay, but we enrolled everybody. So going from left to right, we have the BRCA mutation patients. Then we have the patients in the middle that were not BRCA mutated, but had HRD positive. And then on the far right were HRD test negative or negative biomarker. And you see that those are more modest. We were worried a little bit about the impact on overall survival. We don't have time to get into it, but PARP inhibitors may change how the tumor behaves. And so this was just reported this year, showing there's no difference in overall survival. We'd have liked to have seen an advantage, but because of crossover with about 60% of patients who didn't originally get a PARP, getting a PARP, that's probably diluted out. And we could talk about that all day, and that's what exactly what we do. Apollo 1 was the only trial that had an active comparator. So it was a laparib again, but instead of going against placebo, it was a laparib plus Bev, which Shannon alluded to, the antivascular therapy, bevacizumab. It's hard for me to say bevacizumab, so I say Bev, okay? Versus Bevalo, all right? I can sit here and say bevacizumab, and I sound like Dinkle, but all right. So, and again, we're looking at 2-to-1 and for over 2 years. For the olaparib, 1 year on the Bev, okay? And here we go again. This is the updated survival that Isabel Rake-Ricard presented a couple years ago at a meeting. Look at 5 years recurrence. 46% have not recurred. 5 years versus 15% plus minus 5%, 19%, and that's with Bev. Bev doesn't cure more patients. It helps the disease from coming back. So that shows here. Now, how about in when we're trying to compare apples to apples? So I put this slide together, and I just took the BRCA patients, and I looked at their survival advantage. And you see in Solo 1 in the upper right-hand corner, clear differentiation. Apollo 1 in the bottom right, clear differentiation, no survival. But what was there? What was the difference there? PARP inhibitors were not available for crossover. And so we see minimization of that overall survival when we start giving PARP inhibitors and subsequent therapy. So I started off this talk by saying, in my mind, it's no longer if we give maintenance, but which maintenance do we give? But let's not forget our goal. Curing patients. Curing patients. All right? We need biomarkers in all these patients, and we need to manage toxicity. I'm looking forward to Courtney's talk about toxicity. Thank you.
So, I think it's also important. We were talking last night about what we call the Pelican curves, where it's so wide apart, it looks like, and you don't see that here. There's 46% is great, but there's still patients who are recurring, so we still have more to go. Shannon, I was one of the things we've done a lot is do short videos to distribute. And I have a video of you from the RSGO meeting that I use, that in 30 seconds, I thought summarized where PARP is now. Because it takes a while. This started in 2018. It took several years to sort of sort it out, think about it. We were doing tons of education programs, particularly about this patients without a mutation, because initially there's some suggestion niraparib was going to work in those patients, and it seems now with more of a follow-up, maybe it's not as exciting. But you basically said the algorithm in 30 seconds that we saw ended up, which is if you got BRCA, whether it's a somatic or germline, if you got the LOH test is positive, you're getting a PARP inhibitor. We can talk about which one or whether or not Bev. And if you don't, maybe you're more likely to get Bev. Anything you want to add to that, Shannon? And also the question, again, practically speaking, when do you add Bev to a PARP inhibitor?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first question is, when do you use Bev at all, right? And so I think that the data that we've seen, we see an improvement in progression-free survival, but not overall survival when we add Bev to chemo. This is irrespective of BRCA, irrespective of PARP. And so there was really mixed, I'd say, usage. Some groups used it for everybody. Some groups were a little bit more selective. I know our group definitely was more selective for those patients that had, say, stage 4 disease or had really bulky upper abdominal or a lot of ascites, a lot of fluid that we wanted to dry up with Bev. Now, though, if we haven't started Bev with chemo up front, and then we're getting our testing, and we're getting an idea that our testing is all negative, right? No BRCA, no HRD. We're adding Bev outside of standard of care, but I think a lot of places are doing this. We're adding Bev then, and we're saying, okay, this is a patient that has HRD test negative. We don't really feel great about giving them a PARP inhibitor alone in this setting. Let's give a drug that we know is active. Let's give Bev. So we may add it on, layer it on a few cycles in.
Yeah, it's interesting too. You know, you all really led the way in terms of PARP inhibitors. Whenever, like today, we were this week when we did our prostate program as well as breast, everybody was saying, "Yeah, well, it was the GYN people that really figured out how to use it, the tolerability issues." And then when breast and prostate and pancreatitis came along, we sort of learned from you and Courtney. Of course, one of the big issues was how to get people through the treatment. You know, 2 years, and then niraparib, 3 years. In oncology, we're seeing more and more use of novel agents, oral agents, for a longer period of time. You know, in breast cancer, we've been doing that for a long time with hormonal therapy. But in order to get the benefit, you want the patient to get through the therapy. So let's talk a little bit about some of the issues that may or may not come up with these patients and how you deal with it, Courtney.
Yeah, so now that Dr. O'Malley's explained why we should be giving PARP inhibitors and to who, I'm going to explain the nursing considerations for the patients who are receiving a PARP inhibitor. Prior to patient starting PARP inhibitor, you want to meet with them, do a thorough patient education as far as what to expect, as far as the most common side effects, symptom management, what their schedule is going to look like. We do a lot of video visits at our institution, so they don't have to come in every single month, and then we typically bring them in every 3 months for convenience. You do want to get baseline labs prior to starting treatment to make sure their labs have recovered from chemotherapy before starting the PARP inhibitor. And then you also want to make sure that their PARP inhibitor is approved in a timely manner, too, so start looking into that before they've completed their 6 cycles of chemotherapy and applying for financial assistance if needed. Dr. O'Malley explained how PARP inhibitors work. When I'm talking to patients, I try to simplify it as much as I can, and I essentially tell them that PARP inhibitors block the activity of PARP enzymes, which disrupts the normal DNA repair process and ultimately causes cell death, specifically for patients who have the BRCA mutation. And then I kind of lead into their BRCA result and why we're giving them a PARP inhibitor and explain that tumor cells that carry a BRCA mutation have been shown to have significant sensitivity to the PARP inhibition compared to tumors that do not have the BRCA mutation. The most common side effects for niraparib are thrombocytopenia, anemia, nausea, fatigue, neutropenia, constipation, musculoskeletal pain, hypertension, and then warning and precautions include MDS, AML, which we'll talk about in a minute, hematologic, hypertension, PRESS, and embryofetal toxicity. The most common side effects we see with olaparib are nausea, fatigue, abdominal pain, vomiting, anemia, diarrhea, and then again, the warning and precautions include MDS, AML, pneumonitis, VTE, and embryofetal toxicity. As you can see, there are a lot of overlapping side effects with the niraparib and olaparib. When I'm talking to patients, I really focus on fatigue, GI side effects, and the hematologic toxicity. Early intervention is really important, so educating your patients on what to expect, but also giving them precautions of when they should be calling. What we found is the earlier we intervene or hold treatment to allow them their symptoms to improve, we've definitely been able to keep patients on the same dose longer. For patients having nausea, or if you have a patient who had a lot of nausea with their prior treatment, you might want to recommend doing a scheduled antiemetic 30 to 60 minutes before they take their PARP inhibitor to try to prevent nausea. For patients who are doing that and still having nausea throughout the day, I usually put them on a scheduled like BID dosing of antiemetic, and sometimes even like 3 times a day or 4 times a day, depending on how bad their nausea is. You have to remember that these PARP inhibitors are daily dosing, and so it's not like chemotherapy where they might have 3 to 4 days of nausea. If they're having nausea with the PARP inhibitors, it's often every single day. So have them take it first thing in the morning or, you know, 30, 60 minutes before their PARP to try to prevent it. Constipation is another common side effect. If patients have constipation, put them on a bowel regimen with stool softeners, laxatives, but also conservative with increasing fluids, increasing physical activity, talking to them about diet to help with it too. Some patients have diarrhea, and in that case, you'd want to do a scheduled antidiarrheal. Again, it's daily dosing, so some of these patients have to take an antidiarrheal. I have them take it first thing in the morning when they wake up before the diarrhea kicks in to try to prevent it. If a patient's having diarrhea, you want to make sure they're increasing their fluids. Talk to them about a bland diet. Sometimes we have to give IV fluids, replace electrolytes. Keep those things in mind because they are at risk for dehydration if they're having diarrhea. As far as fatigue, make sure your patients are well hydrated, increasing their physical activity. We've seen huge benefit with referring our patients for physical therapy. And then also sometimes we consider using stimulants for our patients who have fatigue. And then lastly, because of the hematologic toxicity, you want to make sure you have a plan in place of how often you're checking the labs and having someone review them. We do weekly video visits for the niraparib when they require the weekly CBCs to make sure that their counts are okay and they're okay to continue treatment. And then transfuse as needed. This goes over the grade 3 or higher AEs of special interest of the clinical trials that Dr. O'Malley just talked about. The most notable for this is you can see the niraparib had grade 3 anemia, neutropenia, and thrombocytopenia, and then the bevacizumab and olaparib arm and the bevacizumab and placebo arm had grade 3 hypertension. Real quick, there is a slightly increased risk of having AML, MDS with patients who are receiving PARP inhibitors. Oftentimes, the provider is talking to the patient about this when they're recommending the PARP inhibitors, but the patients are going to ask you about it, and so you need to be aware that there is an increased risk, and this is also something that you want to consider when considering how long you're going to keep them on PARP inhibitors, being aware of this risk factor. Both olaparib and niraparib come in tablet form now. The recommended starting dose for olaparib is 300 milligrams twice a day. If a patient has moderate renal impairment or they're on a strong CYP3A inhibitor, you start them at a lower dose level. For olaparib, you just monitor their CBC once a month. Check it at baseline and then once a month. For niraparib, the starting dose is 300 milligrams. The next slide kind of goes over the individualized dosing for niraparib, but if their weight is less than 77 kilograms or their platelets are less than 150,000, you start them at a lower dose level. Niraparib gets weekly CBCs for the first month, and you also want to monitor their blood pressure. And again, that's where those video visits come in handy, checking their labs, checking their blood pressure. This is just a quick slide that goes over the starting at 200 milligrams daily for the patients who have a weight of less than 77 kilograms or 170 pounds, or if their platelets are less than 150. If their weight's above that or their platelets are above 150, then you start them at 300 milligrams. And then dose modification, I think this is really important for nurses to be aware. A lot of our patients on PARP inhibitors have to hold treatment or have to be dose reduced at some point. And telling your patients this early on makes them a lot more likely to be open to the idea of dose reducing or holding treatment. We have a lot of patients who are nervous about holding treatment, especially once they see that it's working or decreasing the dose. And if you tell them ahead of time, there's a really good chance at some point we might have to hold treatment or decrease the dose. They seem to be a little bit more open to the idea. So as nurses, make sure you're talking to your patients about this.
So Jennifer, again, that's a theme we've already talked about several times here at ONS of the potential for dose reduction, particularly for these longer term oral type therapies. And we've talked about, Courtney just mentioned, sometimes patients get very nervous about the dose being reduced. Can you talk a little bit how you think about it and how effective it is in ameliorating symptoms by reducing the dose?
Yeah, first of all, very good point to bring that up early and let your patients know that this probably will happen. Mm-hmm. It's very common that we're dose reducing or holding the PARP inhibitors. And oftentimes, just a dose hold, maybe a week or so, does wonders for the symptoms. If it's like a one-time sort of anemia issue and we transfuse them, sometimes we can put them back on the same dose. Other times, we might want to dose reduce at that point. But the another point to bring up is the lower doses are still efficacious. So I always make sure to tell patients that as well.
So Shannon, again, I can remember when the breast and prostate people saw the AML MDS incidence in the ovarian, they got very, very nervous, you know. You saw 4% versus 8%, but also notice this is in recurrent disease, as chemotherapy increases the risk, and these patients have had a lot of chemotherapy. And it seemed, and we saw this in breast and prostate too, that once you brought it in earlier, they had less chemo, much lower risk. Right now, for a patient such as the one we just discussed, that Courtney and Dave have, what do you say to a patient if they say, tell me exactly what my risk is?
Yeah, I mean, I tell them basically it's around 1%, probably based on the data. And again, like Dave said, we want to give our best drugs as early as possible because we want them to work as well. But it's also the case of it may be safer, too, to give our best drugs early as possible in this setting. And as you mentioned, you know, when we give it in the recurrent setting, it can still be safe. But we used to just continue the PARP inhibitor forever in the recurrent setting, and that's probably not safe. So I think having a nice duration of therapy that we know we can give it for 2 or 3 years, and we have the lowest chance of developing something that could end up being a tragedy, it makes us feel stronger and more confident when we counsel these patients.
So Dave, maybe you can summarize a very complicated story in terms of the use of PARP inhibitors in the recurrent disease setting. And the fact that the FDA looked at some of these numbers that we just showed and actually pulled back the indication for using PARP inhibitor recurrent disease, and yet this came out at SGO. There are situations you might have a patient like your patient, she could end up recurring, and would repeating PARP in a patient like that who had a prior PARP be a consideration? Are there situations right now where you can or do use a PARP inhibitor in the recurrent disease setting?
So the OREO trial was done in Europe, and it looked at PARP after PARP, and that did show a difference in those patients. Diving down into that data, the only person I would consider PARP after PARP is that they're on clinical trial or they did not progress on a PARP previously. If our patient recurs 3 years after starting a PARP, I absolutely would consider bringing a PARP back in maintenance therapy down in the future. But if she would have progressed while on PARP, outside of a clinical trial where we have trials that are trying to overcome PARP resistance, I'm not going to do it. Now, we hope, with the education of all of us, that everybody gets germline and somatic testing. And we identify patients who are going to benefit the most from this therapy, BRCA patients. And those are now the only indications of the U.S. which persist in the recurrent setting, BRCA patients. But we don't ever want to use that. We all want to use it up front. So make sure we get tested, all right?
So we're going to move on in a second and talk about other strategies being used in ovarian cancer. Again, we did an entire program on HER2-positive ovarian cancer. A couple of years ago, I never could have imagined that. But now we have an antibody-drug conjugate that's actually approved for any cancer where you have a positive HER2 assay. And now after all this experience in breast cancer, we're following these other disciplines, including gynecologic oncology, now using this agent. Really an interesting development because, again, the general oncologists have already used it in breast cancer, but we get into, you know, GI cancers. We're going to talk about Saturday afternoon. We use HER2 therapy there. So, Dave, let's talk a little bit about some of the new developments. This is a case where a patient gets a PARP inhibitor maintenance, but then has later on disease progression. Remember, not everybody is cured here. They get a couple more cycles or treatments with chemotherapy. Now they're resistant to platinum, but found to be HER2 positive. And I would just say any patient with recurrent ovarian cancer, it'd be a really good idea to take a look at the chart and make sure they have a HER2 test on there, because there's, as you'll see, an effective treatment option available. So, Dave?
HER2 and folate receptor. Every single patient. So let's talk about that. And I think when we look here, we're learning a ton from the breast cancer. We're teaching them about PARPs. They are teaching us about TDXD. So what is an antibody drug conjugate? We have a drug which connects to a protein on the cancer cell, differentially expressed versus normal cells. So HER2 is not expressed on normal cells, expressed on the cancer cells. It connects. It's linked to a cytotoxic payload, a chemotherapy. That chemotherapy in TDXD, because again, meds say trastuzumab deruxtecan, it's a little tough, so I'm going to call it TDXD, okay? Still a generic name, okay? All right, so it has a cytotoxic payload of a TOPO1 inhibitor drug. So I think when we're looking at this, making sure we know what the payload is essential and what the target is. I used to think linkers were a bunch of crud, but the new technology, the linker's important too, but that's for a different day. Maybe a couple years from now, ONS. All right, so why did Neil just say test everybody, okay? Because the expression is seen across tumor types, and the recent FDA approval is in 3+, using gastric scoring, we're not going to get into that, 3 plus HER2 positivity. So on this graph, beautiful paper looking across disease sites, you see the difference between those that had any expression versus those with 1 plus, 2 plus, and 3 plus. So on the left, schematically, on the right, in a table form, whatever your preference is. But when we look across there, endometrial is high, ovary is modest, and we have about a third of the patients who are going to be positive. But what is positive? And that's what was funny about that case. I don't know what positive is, but we definitely know 3 plus is a positive. So in the same paper, they looked at the breast cancer literature, because I get asked this all the time. When should I test? We usually say the most recent biopsy. We also say, should we send the primary tumor and the metastatic? We don't know. I wish we could send both, but there's some challenges. So this trial looked at primary versus metastatic. You look at the bottom of those greens, the HER2, there's not much difference from the primary versus metastatic. When you have a HER2 low, you'll see some migration in HER2 negative on the metastatic. And then when we look at the cross time, first, second, and third biopsies, again, you see some migration. So in general, I'd send the most recent tissue, but I have to admit, if I send the primary and it's negative, I will send the metastatic because that's really what's dictating care in the recurrent setting. And what we're alluding to, this landmark paper, and it's called Destiny Pan Tumor 02, and it went across solid tumors, and you see here the expression, when you look at this graph, you have to be careful because on the far left of each of the triplets are all the patients. The middle is 3 plus and the next is 2 plus. But as my seventh grader taught me using a little algebra that the alls, which means the 0 and 1 plus, look pretty similar to the 2 plus. And we're going to talk about that in GYN. So the FDA said, look at how good 3 plus is. We're going to give you an agnostic indication for 3 plus. And this was the data I was waiting for, presented Dr. Lee last year at IGCS. And we see here, this is centralized testing. For the patients to go on the trial, they had to have local testing of 2 plus or higher. But when they tested centrally, they found that some of those that were called 2 plus locally were called 1 or 0. And you see that. We see activity across even 0. Am I advocating to give TDXD in 0? No, I'm not. I'm advocating is we need to figure out a better test, and we need to identify those patients who are going to benefit more. But we see activity across the GYN tumors at all levels of expression. So we're taking that data, and we're designing a phase 3. Joyce Lewis from Boston is the lead of this trial in ovarian cancer, and they are allowing ovarian cancer 1, 2, 3 plus for patients in the first-line setting who are not a candidate for a PARP inhibitor. I would argue that's HRD test negative, but that can be interpreted. But there are other ADCs. Our TDXD, we saw Katie Moore presented this data last year, and we see, again, a similar payload. The deruxtecan is referring to the topoisomerase payload, but this is, again, CDH6, another target. That's pretty amazing waterfall plot. Everybody got disease regression except for two patients. And the overall response rate we use with the RESEX activity, which is what we report, is 49%. That led to the design of another phase 3 trial, which is ongoing right now. First, we have to figure out the dose. That's called dose optimization. That's what the phase 2 is. And that's enrolling now, okay? That's what I can say publicly. And once we figure out the dose, then we're going to compare it to the standard of care arm. Okay, standard of care chemo, excuse me, and they're listed there. GEMSAR, PLD, topotecan, or paclitaxel. So we are going to start in a similar, in that case, it was recurrent ovarian platinum-resistant cancers. We're testing in the early stages, and now we're, and at the same time, we're testing the recurrent setting. So we're trying to bring, Shannon alluded to this earlier, bring those best therapies earlier on in treatment. Clearly, we have an active agent, TDXD, antibody-drug conjugate. It is the era of antibody-drug conjugate. A lot of the work Shannon and I are doing is the post-ADC world, okay? We need to figure out the testing, and we need to get patients enrolled on clinical trials. Yeah, I'm already at time, Neil, but this is an amazing case in a patient who was on a clinical trial. Line of therapy was the third. She's on a clinical trial. We treated her with a checkpoint for 5 years. At that time, we found out she was mismatch repair deficient. She had some challenges at that clinical trial from actually financial and said, I will not go on a clinical trial again. So she came in, we tested her. She's HER2 positive. She continues to get treated. You see that big Goomba, that circle, that was a symptomatic abdominal wall recurrence. And you see here, she's an ongoing partial response, and we just treated her with her actually 21st cycle. I think that was last week, right, Court?
A couple weeks ago, yeah.
So pretty amazing we're seeing this type of response.
So pretty amazing being in medical oncology nowadays. I was just flashing on the fact we did an entire hour program recently on HER2 positive biliary tract cancer. That was one of those tumors there. Also the fact that we talked on Wednesday night about how effective T-DXd in breast cancer is in so-called HER2 low, 1+ or 2+. We don't really have a lot of data outside of breast cancer yet to know if it's going to be effective, if it's going to be approved. It's approved in breast cancer, even ultra low, which is almost none there. You still see very good responses. So, Shannon, question from the audience. You know, there's another kind of thematic issue in oncology we've been talking about all week, is that often there are multiple agents in the same type of drug. I'm going to go back to PARP because we got a question from the audience about choosing between niraparib and olaparib. And, you know, you have to compare the olaparib data to the niraparib indirectly because they weren't compared directly. I'm curious how you think it through. From your point of view, Shannon, are they equally effective, you know, in BRCA patients? And if so, how do you decide which one?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely class effect, right? So if we've got the target, that drug that hits that target or takes advantage of that target should work, right, if it does its job. And all of the clinical data would indicate that niraparib, that olaparib, that rucaparib, they do their jobs. So then we've got to use some different nuances. We look at the FDA indication, right? What are we likely going to get an approval for it? And my colleagues have referenced this. We want to make sure that the patient can afford the drug, right? So we also look at things like side effects and pre-existing toxicities. And so certainly, you know, niraparib, for example, it can cause hypertension. So if I've got a patient that already has pre-existing hypertension, perhaps I look towards olaparib. Conversely, niraparib doesn't have as much interaction with different drugs, drug-drug interactions. And so if I have a patient that already has polypharmacy, I might lean towards niraparib because I know that her drug's not going to interact with all the drugs she's already on.
What about, and we know you mentioned, or Dave mentioned, that only PARP approved without BRCA, the wild-type patients, is niraparib. Or what are the situations where you would use niraparib in a patient who doesn't have a BRCA mutation or an LOH positivity?
Yeah, I mean, I think Dave and I have both already referenced this. I feel really uncomfortable not giving some kind of maintenance therapy to a patient with advanced ovarian cancer because I know her chance of recurrence is so high. So if I haven't started bevacizumab or if that was something that was perhaps contraindicated for her at the beginning, then I'll talk to her about the existing data for niraparib. And it really then comes down to shared decision making, right? We all have those patients that want to do something, no matter what that something is, and they'll take any risk or they'll take any adverse toxicity. And then we also have patients that have that idea of like, I would just like to be done for a little while and come what may, I'll take that if I can have, you know, 3 months off. And so I think really that's where shared decision making comes in around, yes, you know, this is what the potential benefit is. Let's weigh those risks and benefits for you.
Jennifer, from a patient education point of view, what are some of the things you think about with a patient who's going to start niraparib versus olaparib? Or is it pretty much similar?
They are very similar. With niraparib, it's a little bit harder on the bone marrow. So especially if you've had someone that had some trouble getting through upfront chemo with some thrombocytopenia or neutropenia anemia, the recommendation is to actually monitor weekly for a month, the CBC weekly for a month, where olaparib, some physicians and NPs will do weekly and some will just go right to monthly. So that's a little bit different. And then with niraparib, as Shannon mentioned, it can cause hypertension. Olaparib, there are class effects, but they also have their unique things, right? So olaparib, there's a risk of pneumonitis of all things. So just knowing those unique side effects and knowing your patients well.
again, you're trying to compare indirectly. I hear more about anemia with olaparib, thrombocytopenia. Courtney, I think you may have alluded to the dosing of niraparib, the weights and plates. How does that play out in practice?
Yeah, we've definitely seen benefit. Initially, we were starting everyone at the same dose level of 300 milligrams daily, and we are having to significantly dose reduce a lot of our patients or stop therapy because of severe thrombocytopenia. And so since doing the weights and plates and dosing, doing the individualized dosing, our patients seem to tolerate it a lot better, and their hematologic toxicities improve too.
Actually, Shannon, I was just flashing on another mini video I did of you from the SGO meeting talking about the question that always comes up in any cancer: what about immune checkpoint inhibitors?
Yes.
And there have been a lot of studies looking at that, and it was interesting because there were a couple of studies looking at, I think, olaparib as well, but nothing really convincing. And the bottom line was, I heard you say we're waiting for the first trial. What's the first trial?
Yeah, so yes, to your point. Well, maybe next time you should just have me on camera.
Yeah.
Have a video of me. You don't have to pay for me to come
She's
here.
Like, yeah.
The bottom line is, can we add immune checkpoint to the pre-existing PARP inhibitors to bevacizumab? And the first trial is potentially going to answer that. So the patients with advanced ovarian cancer get chemotherapy, bevacizumab, and a PARP with or without immune checkpoint inhibitor, dostarlimab. And so that's going to tease out the question of the addition of immune checkpoint to PARP and Bev.
It's starting to sound like multiple myeloma with five drugs.
Yes.
Really interesting. But, you know, if it worked, again, myeloma, they use four drugs all the time to start therapy. And now this is with niraparib. There are other studies. You were mentioning there, too, that the way the study was designed, the other studies weren't designed exactly to answer the question, but this one, if this turns out to be positive, are you going to use niraparib or are you going to use any PARP inhibitor?
That's a great question. I think we're going to have to see how positive. We're going to see what the data look like, right? I'm hedging a little bit. Forgive me. But I think you would start with the where the data are the strongest. And so if it is positive, then you'd be looking at using niraparib and dostarlimab. But with that being said, some of the other studies that have looked at this, for example, DUO-O, that study was written more like a PARP inhibitor trial. We didn't get to answer the question of what the addition to the checkpoint really did. It was missing arms. We have a bunch of trials with missing arms. And so when it came back positive, we were left with the question with, well, what would have happened if we just gave PARP here? So I'm hoping first will be a little bit more definitive and really will help us, because everyone, all the patients want immunotherapy, right? It's on all the commercials. They're like, is this drug right for you? And they're like, is it? I want that. So yes. So I'm hopeful, you know, we've been hedging like, no, but you know, maybe we'll get some more data.
Yeah. Well, you know, immunotherapy's gotten into the Super Bowl commercials. So
that's,
you know,
right. That's what I'm talking about.
aware of it. And, you know, it also gets into another theme in oncology. Again, when you have multiple agents in the same class, this came up actually in lung cancer. You're talking about this, where all the positive trials are with pembrolizumab, advanced metastatic disease. But then the only positive trial in the locally advanced disease was for another IO, durvalumab. But even though everybody thought IOs are all the same, that's the one they use because you stick with in the trial. So we'll see what happens with this first trial. And also, you made a great comment, too, that these studies, when they're designed, we don't know what's going to be happening. By the time they're mature, 3-4 years later, things are different. And so it's hard to pick the exact way to do it. But I hope, I don't know, we're going to see the results from this study soon. Okay, well, let's go on. We were talking about TDXD. I diverted out there because I'm getting a lot of questions here about PARP, but Courtney, let's talk about the nursing considerations with TDXD.
Sure. Just like the PARP inhibitors, patient education is really important, so you want to talk to them about what TDXD is and why they're receiving it. You also want to talk to them about potential side effects and what to expect, as well as symptom management. You also want to talk to them about pre- and post-medications. We've definitely found that implementing pre-meds and home meds has significantly improved the side effect profile. And then baseline labs and procedures. Patients receiving TDXD do require baseline echo. Dr. Malley talked about TDXD and how it works. When I'm telling my patients how it works, again, I try to simplify it as much as possible. I tell them that there's three parts. There's this monoclonal antibody, And then there's the payload, which I tell them is like the chemotherapy, and then a linker that connects the two. And how does that work to treat their cancer? Essentially, this monoclonal antibody targets the HER2, which we know that they're positive because they're getting T-DXd, and then it's linked to the chemotherapy, and the chemotherapy releases within the cells, causing cell death. And explaining it to that way kind of helps the patients understand why they're getting it, and I also use it as an opportunity to talk to them about their HER2 results and why we're recommending T-DXd. The most common side effects with T-DXd are nausea, fatigue, vomiting, alopecia, constipation, decreased appetite, diarrhea, musculoskeletal pain, and hematologic. The most common hematologic we're seeing is anemia and neutropenia. We also see thrombocytopenia, increase in LFTs, as well as hypokalemia. There's also a risk of ILD or pneumonitis associated with T-DXd. So 15% of patients receiving T-DXd did have pneumonitis. 87% of those patients had their first event within the first year. The median time to onset was about 5 to 6 months. So this is something really important to talk to your patients about. There's this five strategies that helps, but essentially prior to starting treatment with T-DXd, you want to make sure you're talking to them about the risk of ILD. And you want to tell them signs and symptoms that they need to report. Every time they come into clinic, you want to ask them if they're having cough, shortness of breath, fevers. You also want to look at their vital signs and make sure that they haven't had a drop in their oxygen level. We've certainly had patients come in who are not having any symptoms, but their oxygen level is much lower than their baseline. When we get imaging, we find that they do have pneumonitis. So talk to your patients about symptoms to be looking for, but also make sure you're assessing them at every visit. The five S strategies, screen, so be careful in what patients you're considering for T-DXd if they're at high risk of pneumonitis. Get the baseline imaging to make sure they don't have any pre-existing lung disorder that would increase the risk of pneumonitis. And then the synergy means work as a team. So make sure everyone in the office, the nurses, nurse practitioners, physicians, patients, everyone's aware of this risk of ILD or pneumonitis, and everyone's on board looking for any signs or symptoms indicative of pneumonitis. If there's any suspicion for T-DXd, you want to suspend or hold treatment until proven otherwise. If ILD or pneumonitis is confirmed, then you want to treat them with steroids. So screen, scan, synergy, suspend, steroids. Again, monitor all of your symptoms, talk all your patients for symptoms, talk to them about signs and symptoms to be looking for. Every visit, make sure you're assessing them. If ILD is suspected, you want to hold treatment. You want to work them up for ILD. If they have grade 1 pneumonitis, which is asymptomatic, you hold T-DXd until it resolves and then restart them at the same dose level. If it takes more than 28 days for their pneumonitis to resolve, then you would restart them at the next lower dose level. You can consider steroids for a grade 1 pneumonitis, but they don't have to be given. But you do need to hold T-DXd until it resolves. Per the package insert, if a patient has grade 2 or higher pneumonitis, then you permanently discontinue T-DXd, and at this point you would give them steroids. This just kind of goes over the management of the most common AEs that we're seeing with T-DXd. First, for the anemia, neutropenia, thrombocytopenia, sometimes you need to transfuse, sometimes just holding their hematologic toxicities improve. A lot of our patients are requiring growth factor, so keep these in mind. If you're having patients with neutropenia, thrombocytopenia, anemia, make sure you're adding the growth factor if indicated, holding, dose-reducing, or transfusing as needed. When we first started using T-DXd, we were seeing a lot of nausea on the phase 1 clinical trial. Now that we've implemented pre-medications and home medications with antiemetics for our patients really aren't having that much nausea. So make sure you're using pre-meds and the IV prior to giving T-DXd, but also sending them home with 3 to 4 days of home antiemetic regimen to help prevent nausea. With doing this, it significantly decreased the risk of nausea vomiting. Fatigue is very common. Make sure you're assessing patients for fatigue at every visit. Consider holding dose reducing depending on how severe it is. You also want to rule out other causes. And again, consider physical therapy. We've seen a lot of benefit in our patients receiving physical therapy while undergoing cancer treatment. Because it can cause left ventricular dysfunction, patients do need to get a baseline echo and then every 3 to 4 months while on treatment. If a patient develops diarrhea, you first want to rule out any infectious cause. Once that's been ruled out, you want to start them on an antidiarrheal. Unlike PARP inhibitors, this is every 3-week regimen, so it's not something that they have to be on every single day, but some of our patients do require to schedule antidiarrheals. It seems to kick in about 5 to 7 days after their dose, so just because they don't have it the first few days doesn't mean that they won't develop diarrhea. all of your patients starting TDXD should have an antidiarrheal available at home in case they do develop diarrhea. Talk to them about when to take it, but also make sure they're calling if they develop diarrhea. TDXD can also cause alopecia, so make sure you warn your patients that they might lose their hair, order them a wig if needed, and then some of our patients are electing to do the scalp cooling. TDXD is given IV infusion once every 3 weeks. The initial infusion is given over 90 minutes. If the patient tolerates it without any infusion-related reaction, all subsequent infusions are given over 30 minutes. It is important, real quick, that TDXD is given until disease progression or unacceptable toxicity, so make sure all of your patients are aware that they will continue receiving TDXD as long as it's working and as long as they're tolerating it. So it's not like some of the prior chemotherapies where maybe they got six cycles and then moved to a maintenance setting. They will continue getting TDXD as long as they're tolerating it and as long as it's working. The recommended starting dose for TDXD is 5.4 milligrams per kilogram. If they require dose reduction, the first dose reduction is 4.4 milligrams per kilogram, and the second and final dose reduction is 3.2 milligrams per kilogram. But I really can't emphasize enough how much supportive care helps. So hold treatment, use your supportive care mitigation strategies before just jumping to dose reduction if you think it's safe. Infusion-related reactions are rare, but it did happen in 1 to 3% of the patients, so be on alert for this. If a patient has a grade 1 infusion-related reaction, reduce the infusion rate to 50%. If it's grade 2, you temporarily stop the infusion. Grade 3, permanently stop. Quick case study just to end the TDXD. So this patient had recurrent high-grade serous ovarian cancer. Her IHC was notable for HER2 3+, and she was folate receptor 0%. She was initially diagnosed in 2020. She completed adjuvant carboplatin paclitaxel, followed by PARP maintenance. She then recurred in 2023 and was treated with GemCis-Bev, followed by Bev maintenance for 9 months. Once she progressed, she was retreated with GemCis-Bev, progressed after 3 cycles of maintenance Bev, and then she became platinum resistant. And at that point, because of her HER2 3+, she was started on TDXD. After 3 cycles of TDXD, she had a near complete response. She tolerated treatment well with the expected side effects. She had fatigue, some diarrhea, but with supportive care, we did not have to dose reduce or hold her treatment. We just used the supportive care measures. She's maintained the same dose every 3 weeks. She really enjoys traveling, and she's been able to continue to do that while staying on treatment with TDXD, and she's overall tolerating it really well. We'll repeat imaging after 6 cycles, but right now she had a nice response after the first 3 cycles.
How is she feeling? Did she have tumor-related symptoms before she was on TDXD?
She did. She had abdominal pain, early satiety, and both of those improved after the first infusion and within a few days of the first infusion.
Yeah, you know, I was mentioning how the pandemic affected our ability to present cases. We've now been, and we did this at SGO in the HER2 meeting, we do these little mini videos of docs in practice presenting cases. And so we had this plan that we were going to present cases of HER2-positive gynecologic cancer. And I'm like, I don't know if they've got any of those. It just was recently approved. And it was amazing to talk to these doctors. Everybody had cases like this one. And it kind of reminded me about 3 or 4 years ago, like the smile that came on their face when they were presenting. I remember one of the docs, it was the first time she used TDXD, and the patient had this great response. And I remembered the docs 3 or 4 years ago in breast cancer going, wow, this thing works. But Jennifer, the other issue is the tolerability issues. Any comment a little bit more about GI issues, you know, acute sort of chemo-like side effects? And one thing I've heard from the breast people, curious what your experience has been, is the value of olanzapine in these people.
Mm. Yeah, good questions and comment. While Courtney was talking, I was thinking back to our first experiences with TDXD, and I was kind of caught off guard, to be honest, with how toxic it can be. But once we kind of got the hang of it and put on the right antiemetics and got kind of a standard schedule down, it went much better. And we actually, I wanted to mention, have a patient with a platinum refractory disease who is now a year on TDXD with a partial response ongoing and is feeling great. So it is definitely an active drug. In terms of GI side effects, we will do steroids prior to treatment, as well as something like ondansetron. And then that night, we'll start olanzapine. And we'll do either 2.5 or 5 milligrams based on based on the patient's comorbidities and how old they are, that sort of thing. And we'll continue that for 5 nights, actually. And then for steroids, we'll continue those for 2 or 3 days, depending on how they do. And that's something we can even taper out a little bit if someone has a really hard time. And then I think Courtney mentioned diarrhea, too, which can be a huge issue for this drug, so much so that we've had people come in a week later each cycle for some electrolytes, IV infusions. But I think this is where nursing comes into play so much, because it's all about that education, the early recognition, the relationship with the patient saying, you call me no matter what, no matter when. We'll figure it out.
So another word in terms of TDXD, Shannon, in terms of ILD. Again, it was interesting when this pan-tumor approval came out and we started to hear from, you know, the GU docs and the GI docs, and they had heard about ILD and they were saying, oh, we need to watch for symptoms. And we're like, no, you got to get it before it's symptomatic. You want to get them grade one without symptoms, just imaging. Now, the breast people image these patients, if, you know, every 6 to 9 weeks, trying to find the earliest changes. Is that the strategy you use, Shannon?
100%. We are real twitchy about ILD because we've had some patients get real sick real fast. And so you cannot sleep on it. So you keep your imaging, and it can't just be a chest x-ray. It has to be a CT scan. And the minute you see anything, even if you think, oh, that patient was sick and probably this is just inflammation, you can't make those kind of assumptions, because once you get past grade one, you don't get to use that drug anymore. And you know, the recommendations are that if it's just grade one and it resolves, you can restart at the same dose. We've been considering reduction quite a bit because we don't want to accidentally get a patient right to grade two and then lose the opportunity to give this really, really active drug.
Yeah, we hear cases all the time in breast cancer of people who get picked up as grade one, they get it restarted, they continue with their response, so really critical. All right, Jennifer, let's talk about some other nursing issues in ovarian cancer.
Great. All right, I'm excited to present this case. I know we shouldn't say this, but one of my favorites. we've been talking a lot about clinical trials, and we'll get into it in a little bit, but how you present clinical trials and when you present clinical trials to our patients is so important. So this patient is a young 39-year-old. She's a therapist, an artist, an avid traveler, and she now has platinum-resistant ovarian cancer. She had negative genetics, folate 1 receptor negative, HER2 negative. So she didn't have a lot of options. So we did present a clinical trial to her, and she went on it. She's had a great response. You can't really see that list, but that's her to-do list of local places around New England she wants to visit. The Troll is a troll from the botanical gardens in Maine. It's a picture of her with her family doing a zip lining thing. So this has all been done when she's on clinical trial, which is so amazing. So I get a couple different groups of people when you're presenting a clinical trial to patients. The first group is people that are kind of like, whatever you say, I want to beat this. I don't care the cost, the toxicity, whatever you're recommending, I want to do. Then you have that middle group that's kind of like, I'm not sure, I want some more information. You can usually explain in detail what's going on, and they'll kind of make a shared decision. And then you have a group that feels very uncomfortable with clinical trials. Maybe they had a family member with a bad experience, or just things that they've heard, you know, in the media, or lifelong just negative effects that they've heard of clinical trials. So that's really the group we want to kind of concentrate on and spend as much time on as we can. I always want to bring up, there are some advantages. As we've seen presented here today, there's a good potential you're going to get an active drug. We've had a lot of FDA approvals in the last 5 or 10 years. You have your own clinical trial team with a clinical trial nurse and a clinical coordinator that coordinates all your visits, and you'll keep your same team. So I will be there, your doctor will still be there, your nurses will still be there. And then a lot of people often say that they feel good about contributing to ovarian cancer research or contributing to the fight. There are a lot of barriers, though, with clinical trials. Especially at first, the visits can be very frequent, as we know. So especially in Boston, where there's a ton of traffic, people could be coming 2 to 3 hours multiple times a week. And that's a lot of time. That's money. And oftentimes, actually, at all of our sites locally, there aren't clinical trials available yet. Hopefully that's coming in the pipeline, but that's another barrier. Eligibility requirements, they're often very strict. So it's really important that we're presenting clinical trials at each phase of the cancer trajectory, meaning at each progression of disease, because the longer you wait, sometimes they have a 2 or 3 line limit. And then just to communicate with the patients, I touched on this a little bit, but a lot of people have this negative connotation, like, I don't want to be a guinea pig. I don't want a placebo. But then you explain, oh, there are no placebos on this trial, and they think about it a little bit differently. And then I always want to stress that no matter what the patient decides, we are your team. You're not going to be treated differently if you don't do this, because I think sometimes people feel a little bit of pressure. And then sometimes the pharmaceutical companies will give vouchers and help pay for hotel stays, so that's something to keep in mind as well. So good time to kind of talk about optimizing this oncology nursing care. It's a good time to check in at each progression. What are your goals? How has this changed since your first diagnosis? It's good to introduce palliative care. And these are hard conversations, right? They're not conversations that are going to happen in one visit, but just kind of establishing and keeping that nursing relationship with the patients is so important. Of course, we'll want to, like Courtney has talked a lot about, educating the patients on not only their disease, you know, what does it mean that I'm stage 3 or stage 4, but on the management of different side effects of whatever trial they're on or whatever chemotherapy regimen they're on. We have all sorts of support resources, social work, lifestyle medicine is kind of an up-and-coming thing that can help optimize patients' health outside of their oncology care. And then, of course, you want to be mindful of social, financial barriers. And I love the motto, never worry alone. This is, again, where the nurse-patient relationship comes in so much. And that's what I tell all my patients. If you're worried about something, it's never too small. You wouldn't believe the messages I get. Just reach out. And then I think we've already touched on the multidisciplinary approach, and I'm running out of time here. So back to our case. She's just a truly amazing patient, and we're so happy for her. She's been in a partial response, symptom-free for over a year now on this clinical trial. She's really given back and is involved in the Turning the Tide, which is an ovarian cancer retreat up in New England. And she is now teaching Tai Chi classes to other cancer patients.
So, you know, really good thought to keep in mind. This is a potential benefit to the patient. That wasn't that long ago. When you look at some of these trials or comparing chemotherapy A to chemotherapy B, that you, either one you could get in the community. Now you see agents you can't get, like this patient. Think about the patients who went on that Solo 1 trial, the people who got the olaparib or on that curve. And then your patient, I'm looking at it, she got started in 2020, was presented in 2018. So, you know, there's a benefit to the patients participating as well. Let's talk about, you know, it seems like every time we do a program, regardless of tumor type, the issue of antibody drug conjugates comes up. Again, I refer you to our program Wednesday. We went spend an hour and a half about ADCs, but in ovarian cancer we have mirvetuximab. Let's talk a little bit, and here we have a biomarker again that we're looking for, folate receptor alpha. We'll talk about the considerations in starting a patient on this. But Shannon, can you talk about what we know from the clinical research about this agent?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm excited to talk about mirvetuximab, soravtansine. I don't know why you have such a hard time. But in solidarity to Dave, I'm going to call it Merv.
Merv.
So we've seen the typical course of ovarian cancer, and a lot of us have been mentioning platinum-resistant, platinum-sensitive, and this is just meant as a little bit of a reminder, right? So if we have a patient whose tumor comes back more than 6 months after the completion of platinum, they're technically platinum-sensitive, and for them, we can consider platinum again. It's the patient population that has recurrence of disease prior to this marker within 3 months, within 4 months, or even platinum refractory when they have a recurrence during platinum. That's where we have a really huge area of unmet need. And we used to say, at least I used to say, to patients when they presented with platinum-resistant disease, this is an incurable disease. But now we have data like we just saw with TDXD and also with MIRV that there are patients that potentially can be cured. So MIRV targets folate receptor alpha, and as Dave told you, when you use these ADCs, you want a target that's not necessarily expressed on normal cells, and these are very highly expressed in ovarian cancer as well as some other cancers, and especially in epithelial ovarian cancer and high-grade serous, which is arguably one of our worst actors, there is a high proportion of patients that will have expression. Now, this is all expression, and any expression is not necessarily associated with benefit to MIRV, so we'll talk a little bit about what that means. Right now, the way we test for expression, this is something that you can get, your institution might do it, or you may have to do a send out. There are a number of labs that will do this. We use the so-called PS2 scoring, which is determined based on how strongly the cells stain and the proportion of cells that stain, and we get a 1, 0, 2 plus or what have you. We're looking for 75% expression based on the current use of mirvetuximab. So this is an antibody drug conjugate. You heard a master class on how those work, so I won't go into that in detail. This is a DM4 payload, so a little bit different from some of the other payloads that you've seen. And that matters because if we are potentially going to sequence these, say we have a patient with HER2 positivity and a patient with folate receptor alpha, we can do that. We can argue about which one we would give first, but if there's ultimately the patient can't tolerate or there's progression of disease, we can use both of these because the payloads are different. The initial approval for mirvetuximab was in platinum-resistant ovarian cancer based on the so-called SORAYA trial, which was a single-arm trial, and we saw beautiful response to therapy. So we got an FDA approval solely based on the fact that 31% of patients had reduction in their tumor, and it lasted about 7 months, which that there was nothing to sneeze at. And so we went on, as we do with FDA, to prove this in a larger group of patients, and that was the MIRASOL trial, and this was led by Dr. Katie Moore, where patients, again, platinum-resistant ovarian cancer, folate receptor alpha expression greater than 75% based on that PS2, and 1 to 3 prior lines of therapy were randomized to MIRV or to investigator's choice chemo. And hey, pro tip, if there's more than one investigator's choice chemo, that means none of them are that great, right? And so that you can always look at a trial and understand how great is the standard of care. Not great. So we looked at progression-free survival in this population, and not only did we see progression-free survival benefit, we also got overall survival benefit. This was the first study ever in platinum-resistant ovarian cancer to demonstrate an overall survival benefit. So this was really exciting. And of course, at the bottom, you can see the waterfall plots, right? Those are nice shrinkage of disease. So even though we had a 30% response, you can see that a large proportion of patients had some kind of reduction in their disease, which would be expected to provide symptomatic benefit as well. Now, so as you've learned, right, if we like something in a later line of therapy, let's move it up as soon as we can. So there are a couple of trials that are looking at this drug or have looked at this drug in platinum-sensitive disease. The first is the PICCOLO study, which looked at MIRV as a single agent in platinum-sensitive ovarian cancer with a response rate of 51%, so pretty exciting. Shockingly, we don't really know the response rate of carboplatin here, so I can't say if this is better or worse. It's certainly online with what we'd expect with platinum-based therapy. So this could be an option for patients that test positive for folate in lieu of platinum, if they maybe can't tolerate platinum or have a prior sensitization or a prior reaction. And the duration of response is beautiful, about eight months. And they did do some teasing out, and it seemed to be active in patients that have had prior PARP, prior bevacizumab. So that's important understanding, again, sequencing, that this drug may be very effective.
And then finally, we have the GLORIOSA trial, which is ongoing right now, that is looking to see, can we add MIRV to our standard of care maintenance? And so in this trial, patients have platinum-sensitive disease. They've responded to their platinum. They have folate receptor alpha positive testing, and they're randomized to either continuing BEV that's been started with their chemo or adding MIRV to BEV. And so we'll see if we can change the standard of care for maintenance in this space.
And did you say it's best trial ever?
This is David's trial, and it's an excellent trial. We're so proud of him.
So quick question. This came up at SGO. Dave, now we have two antibody-drug conjugates in ovarian cancer. Talked about T-DXd and mirvetuximab, both with biomarkers. There are some patients who have both. If that's the case, which one comes first, Dave?
You have to go with the overall survival benefit right now. If you had a 3+ and a high folate receptor alpha, that's pretty rare. But you have to go with the ones that have shown overall survival benefit, in my mind. You know, you could say, if you had a clinical trial where you could have access to one and not wait for MIRV, that would not be unreasonable. But I'm going with the OS.
All right. Well, let's finish out talking about nursing considerations and patients getting mirvetuximab. Jennifer?
All right. So I have another case for you all. This is a 64-year-old new grandmother with a platinum-resistant ovarian cancer. She progressed on platinum-based therapy this January with a large pelvic mass that you can see there. It was complicated by rectal bleeding, a lot of pain, hydronephrosis. So we did molecular testing, HER2 negative, and she was found to be folate 1 receptor positive. So, this is her and her new grandbaby and her son.
Aw.
He's very cute. There's another picture later. We've talked about how ADCs work, so I won't get into that. This one, of course, targets folate 1 receptor. I also like to tell people that there is bystander effect. So just because all cancer cells don't overexpress the folate 1 doesn't mean the other cancer cells aren't getting the drug as well. And it's approved for platinum-resistant ovarian cancer with expression greater than 75%. So kind of like PARP inhibitors, ADCs do have sort of class effects, I guess, like the GI toxicity, blood counts, and whatnot, but they also have very unique side effects. And I alluded to this earlier with mirvetuximab, the eye disorder. So this is when you want to pair with an ophthalmologist locally and try to get someone that can kind of help you through this. The most common side effects are blurred vision, dry eyes, irritation, redness. Eye exams are required at baseline, then every other cycle for 8 cycles, and then as needed after that. Neuropathy, that's another big one with this drug, and a lot of patients have already had paclitaxel, right? So they're probably coming in with some sort of neuropathy, so you want to make sure you're paying attention to that, and dose reducing if needed. This was an awful case of pneumonitis on an ADC. This patient ended up getting admitted to the hospital and going on steroids. She's actually turned out well, but you can see those little ground glass opacities in her lungs there. She came in the morning and her O2 sat had dropped to about, I think it was like 90 or 91%. And she said, I am kind of short of breath. I was walking my dog this morning and couldn't breathe very well. I guess so. Yeah. So that's another thing to watch out for with this drug, and the infusion-related reactions can occur as well. So this is another drug we start over a long period of time, and if tolerated okay, you can shorten the length of it. Eye care during treatment, of course, you pair with the ophthalmologist. We have our patients do preservative-free artificial tears throughout the entire time they're on this drug, every single day, at least 4 times a day. And then we give steroid drops as well before and then up to 8 days afterwards. And this is just a little blurb we give to our patients in a packet just so they can keep track, because it is a lot of eye drops if you think about it. Back to our case, I'm happy to report that 3 cycles later, she has had complete resolution of her bleeding. She has no pain. Her CA125 is decreasing. She did have some blurred vision. I sent her back to the ophthalmologist, and she did have some eye changes. So we ended up holding her for 1 week and then ultimately dose reducing her. Her eye toxicity has resolved. She's continued to tolerate really well, and she actually has scans this week. So we're keeping our fingers crossed for her, but there's another picture of that grandbaby, and she also plays an instrument in her church.
So I can really relate to the picture. I have a 1-year-old grandson, and I'm kind of curious, something that we've talked about in the past in ONS is what are her personal goals? You know, this is not a situation likely to be curative. I'm curious what's important to her.
Taking care of that grandbaby
is
what's important to her. She told me the other day that her son drops him off at 3 p.m. and picks him up at 11 p.m. every day. I was like, wow, can you be my my mom?
Yeah. Well, she could get paid in Houston.
Yeah, so just, you know, controlling, because she was so symptomatic that she wasn't even able to pick him up. So controlling her symptoms and taking care and being with her family was what's most important to her.
Neil, you made me very nervous there. You had a bunch of GYN practitioners on. You're talking about kids. I thought you were going to ask us where babies come from. So.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to the faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Nursing Update, and follow this podcast for more great content and edutainment.